bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the Photo Show. I'm Ewan Rankin, and you've got me for the next 40 minutes or so, discussing the week's technology news for photography, and then answering your questions. And we've got a couple of crackers today, thanks to those people that have written in. Well worth it. If you want to send in your photography questions, I'll do my best to answer them. There's one of them I'm going to give you my interpretation. I'm going to get letters, I know I am. Then send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. I'll answer the questions, see how we get on. Who knows what can happen. Straight into it then, because the week in photography news has been violent, maybe, I would say. The first thing is Orphan Works. Not that one. Photography Orphans. These are the images which you get from libraries, Imperial War Museum, that kind of thing, where there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of catalogued photos that they've got. And there's nothing they can do with them. They can't make any money from them. They can't release them to the outside world because they don't know whether there's a copyright on them, and the due diligence on that process would cost them too much. So the government have issued a new piece of legislation. The new piece of legislation is aimed at freeing up all of those works that there are being held by museums and that kind of thing where you can't actually get a copyright license for it. The Act has been passed and it's been given royal assent. There's no statutory instruments gone along with it yet, no regulations or anything like that. But the basic detail of the legislation is oriented to taking things which are in storage and no one knows who owns them and releasing them to the world. And well done, because that's exactly what it's about. But everyone's drawn a parallel and said that the UK government is planning on giving away everything that you've got online for free to big companies. And that just ain't the case. It's not even close to the case. The first thing that you've got is everyone's called it the Instagram Act. Well, you sign up to a series of terms and conditions for the use of their services whenever you go to Instagram or you go to Flickr or any of those places. And nearly all of them will tell you that the use of their of those works becomes the control of the site that you put them on. The principle being that they want to move them around, they want to put them where they want, and they're worried about someone coming along and soon. And whilst doing that, they don't really want to sell them necessarily, although Instagram did have with their terms and conditions last December, they wanted to start doing that process. But it's not going to do that. You've signed your rights away. Now, the first question you've got to ask yourself is whether that was a fair contract term, because in the UK, we've got UCTA, the Unfair Contract Terms Act, and it says that there are things like duress and other elements associated with contracts where you can't take someone away, take a right from someone without giving them some valid consideration in return. Well, some storage space is not going to be an equal value for the copyright of an image that you've given to them. So I think that would be a really good day in court to argue whether that what they'd done in the sign-up terms and conditions of the use of the service was an unfair contract. Plus, you look at someone like Flickr, who charges you $24.95, and if they're charging you for a service and the service value is estimated at $24.95, they can't then start taking other things away from you because that would be outside the remit of the contract and therefore an extra consideration. So I don't think they could sell your images anyway, despite what they actually say. Unfair contract terms would come in. Plus also, there's a certain process in your mind. Well, you've given it away. You've put it online. People are going to use it online. Every week when I do the banners for the shows, I go to Google Images and I look for the Creative Commons images that I can take and I can use. And sometimes I'll take other images which are not in Creative Commons, but I'll alter them beyond recognition within Photoshop so that I can use them. Now, I don't have a problem with that, and I wouldn't have a problem if someone had done that with my works. It's not the end of the world. If I've put it online, I pretty much know I'm going to lose control over it. So all those people that are up in arms, you've effectively given it away anyway to the world, because if it comes in a Google return, then anyone will use it for anything that they want. The next thing you've got to think about is whether actually you really want anything from it. Now, this thing does say that this is for orphans where you cannot identify a copyright owner. That means that any stock image site or any online user of images would have to perform some due diligence to make an effort to at least identify the person who did own the copyright. Well, that's really easy. If you're talking about Instagram, Flickr, Google, all of those kind of places, they've actually had you upload it as a username, and that photograph is associated with your username. Otherwise, it wouldn't come back on your homepage. So there's an instant there, instant association there with the person who does own the copyright for it. So that's not going to go away. I had an email and a tweet this week that said, so all the images on my website are no longer mine. Nothing to do with it. It's on your website. The license holder is clearly identifiable. And if it really comes down to it, and they have stripped away the metadata, you've got the image itself. You can show the original image with the correct IMG number or YRX number out of your can. The raw file itself, which would be something that they wouldn't reproduce from a JPEG that you'd uploaded. That would be impossible for them. So you would clearly show that you had the rights to that image if you went to a court. And if they hadn't done due diligence in finding you, you would win your case. So calm down, everybody. This is designed to let the Imperial War Museum, the National Portrait Gallery, and all those kind of people that have got some stuff that they can't use to allow them to use it. Simple as that. What? Chat room's trying to say it's too big, it looks ridiculous. That's to do with the Olympic Stadium, I think. Never mind. So there you go. That's Orphan Works. Got it out of my system. Next one, Nokia. Nokia's taken a huge amount of money and piled it in to Pelican Imaging. What Pelican Imaging is the ability for them to sample cells across a wide range on sensors and give you the light field camera effect, just like the Lytro does. They're saying that they reckon that they can completely and utterly reproduce the effect of the Lytro camera in high quality using the full megapixelage of your cell phone, but do it in the cell phone with the technology that they've invested in. The images that they've put out are examples. Now, whether these are faked or not, I don't know. But if you go and you have a look at the website, I think Petapixel's got the story on it. There's a picture of a girl stood in front of the Golden Gate Bridge, and it magically transfers into the difference of feel between her being in shot and then the Golden Gate Bridge in the background being completely in shot as well. In focus, rather. It looks like it works. Well done. There's no word on price. There's no word on availability. No one knows what it's going to happen. There's a video that's been released for it to have a look at. That was done in February, but there's no other details. So go and have a watch the video. It's on Petapixel, and hopefully it'll come to your camera near you soon. Sony has they released a thing. I think this goes back to Photokina a long time ago or something like that. August 2010, says the story. They introduced the first pellicle mirror into SLRs, the A33 and the A55. They stopped calling them SLRs and they called them SLTs, single lens translucent cameras. And it was just a different way of reflecting the light up to a viewfinder. But they were specifically made for mirrorless cameras, and they were going to mount really well on APS-C sensored bodies and that kind of stuff. It appears that they're going to cut that. There's a site called Sony Alpha Rumors, which if you're a follower on that site, then I suggest you go out and get a life, because that can't be very well frequented, I wouldn't have thought. If there's loads on there, I do apologise, but I really don't think it's that good. Go and have a look, but the word there is that they're going to go completely away from the pellicle sensor or the pellicle mirror. It does say that they're going to do it on the mirrorless cameras, but people are getting their hopes up that this is going to come to full frame cameras instead, which I don't see myself, to be honest. But if you're excited and you like SonyAlphaRumors.com, then yes, good luck to you. If you want to get rid of old stuff secondhand, or if you want to look for a decent quality secondhand lens, there's a new place that you can go where everyone will know your name. It's called CameraJungle.com. If you go there, you can register with them and you can stick all of your secondhand lenses up for sale, or bodies up for sale, or you can buy secondhand bodies and lenses. I've gone and have a look, and the prices on there seem a little bit high. They could be a little bit higher than you'd probably pay if you went to eBay or something like that. They're taking their cut, I suppose, so that's fair enough. But I like eBay because you do get decent. I've always had good lenses in off eBay. So if this place has got some diligence over images that are uploaded and you've got pictures of the lenses and that kind of stuff, could be a real find. As I say, I did a sample of about three Canon lenses that I knew the price of, and they all appeared to be a little bit higher than I would have expected to pay on eBay. But it's out there. Adam in the chat room says, hold on, Ewan, they've got the A99, which is an SLT, and it's full frame. Now, this is a rumour that says that they're going to discontinue SLT going forwards from this point. So what they've currently got will be SLT. It's the stuff that's coming next that's the big issue. Hasselblad have decided to get rid of the V system camera. Sharp intake of breath. The V system camera was the one that was invented by Victor himself. Victor Hasselblad came up with the idea of having a camera, if you like, that was small and easy to move around. He used the Leica as his model. He wanted something that was equally easy to hold as the Leica that was out at the time. And but he wanted large film in it as well. So he came up with the V system, which gave you a larger film format. I think he copied the Rollei 6x6 format or something. Well, their 503 camera is gone. There is no more. They've not made one now for a couple of weeks. And Dr. Larry Hansen, who's Hasselblad chairman, said, everything has its place in time, and the Veteran 503, combined with an extensive V-System range of interchangeable lenses and accessories, was for 17 years the camera of choice for the discerning professional, an aspirational amateur photographer. But there has been a substantial decline in demand for this camera over the past 5 years or so, and the time has now come for us to reluctantly consign the V-System to history. In so doing, we'd like to thank all fans and customers for both their loyalty and their enthusiasm for our legacy Hasselblad V-System. And all the money that you paid as well, because it was never cheap. Never, never cheap. If you're into Hasselblads, they've just gone up in price then, eh? Olympus have let some pictures leak. Now, I don't know how accurate these are or not, but this is apparently the new EP5. It's a compact camera. This is going back to the EP3 was the last one that it did, and the EP1, the pen one, was the last camera before the very first camera. This is the first one of the kind of $1,000 compact cameras, the overpriced job is, as far as I'm concerned. I've seen some pictures from the pen stuff, and it's okay. It's a nice picture, but people rave about it being like it's the king's new clothes, and I've got to say, I don't see it myself. It's a decent compact camera. The new one is going to have an external viewfinder that you have to buy extra, of course, and that fits on top with your hot shoe, and it's got a tilt-out screen as well. There's no other major specs available, so I can't tell you if it's going to differ greatly from the last one, the EP3. I would suggest it probably isn't. It's going to be very much the same. Maybe some menu changes or some shooting sensor changes, perhaps. But they're all suggesting it's going to be a 16 megapixel sensor, just like the last one as well. And there you have it. I've got to say, if you want to get excited about that stuff, that's up to you. But I never really did. And even when I saw pictures from it, I never saw them as markedly different. You'll get cheaper cameras that do just as well for half the price. Do you know photographer Chris McVeigh? Well, Chris McVeigh likes building replica cameras out of Lego for a hobby. And here's one that Chris made earlier. He's in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and he's taken a lot over the years. He's built Leicas and that kind of stuff. But McVeigh has built the Polaroid One-Step SX70, the Rainbow Instant Camera, purely out of Lego. It looks absolutely authentic. There's a picture on the website that's next to it, which makes it look, it's very, very good. And the nice part is that he's made a little bit of Lego at the bottom that when you push the button, it rolls out of the little slot. So it actually does its own little prints as well. I really like that. I thought that was super cool. Well done to them. IBM have made a movie. Well, okay, they made the movie that zoomed all the way in and zoomed all the way out, didn't it, in the 60s? The one that went to massive quantities of magnification and distance. Well, they've made the world's smallest movie. Everything that you're seeing on the video podcast there, each of those little silver balls is actually a single atom. And it's a single atom that's floating on a surface that they use that's under a microscope with an electromagnetic device on it with a needle on it that can move single atoms. So all of these places, the IBM's research center in Germany have come up with this idea of making a 242 frame film. And it's called The Boy and His Atom. And it's a little thing about a little boy who jumps up and down on a trampoline and they move around. And they spent all their time moving these atoms one by one on the surface. I started to wonder, well, hang on, surely the surface that they're on has got atoms as well. So how have they done that then? Then my brain hurt and I decided to have a cup of tea instead. But you can go and have a watch of it. It's at Engadget.com and just put in IBM Atomic Movie and they'll show you the atoms. It's very impressive. It's damned impressive, says Adam. Yes, it is. Very impressive. The video's not much, though. It's pretty crap. Pentax are giving you an instant rebate on their cameras. And the reason that they're doing it is to celebrate Photography Month. I didn't even know there was a month for photography. There's a new one on me. If you go and buy their stuff, you'll get an instant rebate on it. It doesn't say how much it is, and it doesn't say how much it is on each of the items, so you'll get loads. You can get up to $100, is all that the story said, but you'll get instant rebates on it. And apparently, this month is National Photography Month. I'm thinking that's in America, but there you go. I think I'm going to join in. I'm going to take loads of pictures this month because it's National Photography Month. Someone saw you coming. Watch out. Have you got a Sony Action Cam? Because if you have, they've released a whole pile of accessories. You can get loads of stuff now where you can link it to your snowboard, or you can link it to your surfboard, or you can do windsurfing, or you can do kite attachments. Loads and loads and loads of attachments have come out from them. But the one that struck my eye is this one. They have released, for the Sony Action Cam, a dog strap. If you want to take your Sony Action Cam and strap it to your dog and let your dog go a-wandering and get all the footage from it, now you can do it. Whether it doubles up and you can strap it across your own back, I don't know, because it's on a fairly big dog on the picture that I've got up here. But it's there. You can buy it. There's no word on price. They've just got these things announced, but where you get them, I don't know. Man's best friend will be a man's best camera friend soon. Jolly good. Transcend have released 128 gigabyte UDMA 7 1000 speed compact flash. Now, I don't know if Transcend have noticed, but an awful lot of cameras and video cameras now don't take compact flash anymore. They only want SD cards. So that could be the first limiting factor on this thing. It's been designed for people who shoot video at 128 gig, it would be. Is the price for it, though? It's $699. Yes, nearly $700. You heard me right. This thing will rush you $700. Do you really think it's worth that? 128 gigs, a lot of video. It's a few hours of video. And I'm not sure it's going to be placed so remote that you can't change it, maybe. But as I said, everything I've come across recently wants SD cards. It doesn't want compact flash. So I don't get that. And the price, well, you can keep the price. Talking of keeping the price, Zeiss have released two new lenses. They've called them the Zeiss Tuit. I don't know what Tuit stands for. Apparently, the Tuit is something to do with... I had the thing in a minute. Oh, the name stands for Good Visibility, Agility, Mobility, and Diversity in Qualities. It rhymes with the English phrase, do it, apparently. Yeah. I think someone's thought too hard about that one, but never mind, eh? There's two flavours of lens that are out there. There's the 12mm f2.8, which I'm showing there. And also, they've done, I think, a 1.8. Yeah, a 1.8 32mm, which I'm showing there. They've released some images of it, and there's a parrot, and it looks all right. And then there's a picture of some kind of Bedouin-y type, Egyptian-y type thing at this famous pyramid where they did Raiders of the Lost Ark, or not Raiders of the Lost Ark, Last Crusade. There's one of a rock climber. Nice depth of field on that. Very, very good. It's cranked right up, I would have said, for the f-stop. And it's really pleasant. And also, on the short focus stuff, it's got really good bokeh. So Not bad at all. What is the price? There isn't one. Apparently, there's a 50mm lens coming as well later in the year, about late May. But these things are out there, the 2.8 12mm, 2.8, and the 2.8 32mm, f1.8. No price, but do bear in mind, it's Zeiss, so it's likely to be hugely friggin' expensive. Next thing in the products list is the Samsung NX2000. That's been released this week. It comes with a standard 18-55mm lens. It's interchangeable, which is really nice. The body is really, really small. It's got a larger sensor than normal at 20 megapixels, APS-C CMOS sensor. ISO range of 100-25600, which isn't bad at all. And an image processor called the DryMe 4, which does 8 frames per second if you really want it to. There's some nice faked pictures on the website, and the fake pictures look like they take really good fake pictures, so I'm sure that'll be fine. The nice big lens on the front looks good. I don't know what the balance of it's going to be like with that lens and what the availability of lenses is going to be for it, but it's a pleasant-looking camera, and if it's doing the things that it says it's going to do, shooting full HD video and that kind of stuff, again, we looked last week at the very small compact cameras that are doing great video quality. This could be superb. Could be really superb. It's got a touchscreen on the back as well, which was nice. I liked it. The lens didn't look like it was cheap and crappy on the images I saw. It looked like it was made out of metal and kind of the level of the L-series lens quality. I'll probably be wrong, but it's got Wi-Fi built in too, so that should be pretty good. What's the price then, you're all asking? Well, before I give you the price, and Chatroom can come up with it here, it does come in white, which is not going to look great after a month, black, which will look fine for its entire lifespan, and of course, probably for the Japanese market, it's available in girly pearlescent pink. Why do they do it? I have no idea. I have no idea why they do it. Price on this thing is $650. I thought that was all right. I've got to say, I thought that was all right. Cheapest price at the moment is B&H Video that are carrying it, but I think they've just got a placeholder for it. One of the other things that's really nice with it, though, is you get a free copy of Adobe Lightroom 4, which is just about to go to 5, so we'll have to wait and see. £900, says Adam in the chat room, so he's a long way out, and I'm glad to say. It looks like it's a really good buy. That should come in about the £400 mark. £400 to £450, something like there, would be beautiful. Would I buy it at that? I might. The wife's looking for one of these little cameras. I might get her this. It's good. It's real good. Next thing is Omnivision. Now, Omnivision have created a tiny sensor that will allow you to shoot better quality video in your cell phone, mobile phone. It's so small that it can even work in your front-facing camera. Is it going to shoot 1080p? Yes, it definitely is, which is pretty impressive. What's even more impressive is, though, this thing will shoot 60 frames a second. So not only will you get a decent quality video that will be much improved in terms of the clarity and separation and sharpness that you've got in your existing front-facing camera, you're going to get the improved frame rate too. So 60 frames a second is where it's got to go. I think, everyone's looking at 4K at the moment. You've got to make 1080p 60 frames a second a standard next before you go up to 4K and start trying to pull all that money in. As a pro myself now, I want 60 frames a second as standard in everything that I buy. I do not want to be looking at having to pay extortionate fees for 4K over and above. Please, please, please give me 60 frames a second. And the last story today in the products is a story about a guy who's a German photographer who lives in the UK, and he's created an application where your life can actually, literally, flash before your eyes. He's called it, what's he called it? He's called it Eternal Light for Mac. He's got a beta version that's out there. It looks a bit Star Trek-y on the interface. And effectively, you take this thing, you fill it with your images, and then this thing will actually go and reproduce a slideshow at any pace that you say for the image and crossfade them however you suggest. There's a video on Petapixel of watching it, and it's really quite interesting because he can take thousands and thousands of images and flash them before your eyes so that you can barely even see them. The video shows how fast they can flicker through. He's got it into beta. His name's Peter Basmalord, and this thing is a Kickstarter project. It's $22,000 is the limit, and he's got something like $1,500 at the moment. He's got a beta project, but he wants to turn it into a real sale. I think he'd be better off just doing this and selling it through the App Store, but he's not doing it. He's going through Kickstarter, and all of the low-level entries, which give you the software cheap, have gone. Now, they were all 15 quid, and that's supposedly cheap. So I horror and shudder to think how much this software is going to be when it comes out. It's just a music video maker-y, slideshow-y thing. Let's bear that in mind. It does let music go to it and all that kind of thing, and you do get the super speed on it. But whether it comes out at being really worth 35 quid, which is what I'm guessing the final price is going to be, I don't see it myself. You've ripped everyone off, mate. I won't be buying it. I'll get a review copy. God, blimey, I'm thirsty. Right. Your questions. If you know a story for that we haven't covered one week for the photo news, do email it in and we'll get it covered. It's BritishTechNetwork@gmail.com. See you there. Your questions come to the same address, BritishTechNetwork@gmail.com. We've got three doozies coming up in a moment. But first, let me remind you about the Bash. The Bash is the 6th of July. You need a ticket to come. The ticket is not an entry to a music concert. It is sharing the cost of the day amongst us all. We're hoping to get in a few sponsors to help keep the cost down. But for 20 quid, you'll get free entry. It pays for the venue, which is 400 quid. And it'll get you all the beer and all the food you can drink on the day and have loads and loads of fun. There'll be tons of stuff going on. We'll be doing the podcasts. We've got some sponsorship from 12 South. I think Insanely Great Products are going to give us a little bit of sponsorship and throw some products our way as well, which is fantastic. And we'd love to have TechSmith back again with Betsy and Andy Lee helping us out. So if you haven't bought your ticket, you've got to get it in the next 3 weeks, because in 3.5 weeks' time, tickets will come off sale. And if we haven't sold enough tickets for the venue, I will not be booking the venue. We'll be having it at my house, keeping the cost down, and we'll just have some fun with the people that have already sent some money in. Okay? So please, 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 if you need your ticket, get it now. In the next 2 weeks, just be safe. Make sure we know your numbers, and we'll have a great time. It's lovely. Go to BritishTechNetwork.com. There's a banner on there that looks exactly like the one on the video here. And click it and buy your ticket. Click it and buy your ticket. There you go. See, that's a slogan. Did a slogan already. Right, your questions. First one is from Thomas, who's in Rochester. I don't know if that's in Kent or whether that's Rochester in New York. Hi, Ewan. I know this may sound silly, but on the podcast the other week, you mentioned that an image can withstand an increase in size to 140%. That seemed like an awful lot to increase an image, or am I missing something? It's 140% of original. So for a first thing, that's not me saying take your image and more than double it in size. That's me saying take your 100% image and make it 140% of the original size. So all you've gone up is 40% effectively. Pretty much any camera that you've got, even your cell phone camera, if you put it into Photoshop and do an increase from 100% to 140%, you'll get a small increase and you'll still get good quality of reproduction around it. Once you start going past that 40% mark for me, and that applies because it's percentage-based, it's a factoring process, isn't it? Once you start getting past that for nearly all the cameras I've ever used, I find that you get little artifacts appear, or you get little shapes don't look right, or edges start to go a bit chunky. It's the stuff that says that it can do, you know, fractals and that kind of stuff, so that they can go up to 1,000% and all that kind of stuff. About 140 is good, and it looks good. Once you get past that, it starts to break up. There's a second part to Thomas's question. He says, also, you mentioned bicubic interpolation a while back. I know I've seen that along with other choices in Photoshop CS5 before, but never changed it, as I'd no clue what it does. What's the difference between that and all the other choices? Right. What I'm going to give you is my understanding of what bicubic interpolation is. While I'm just saying that, I can hear myself getting letters in the next couple of weeks telling me I'm a complete arse. But this is what I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll read your reply out. If you take an image, you're going to look at, I've put a grid up on the screen here, And the center pixel wants to be looked at to increase the overall size of the image. Bicubic interpolation is different from the others. Nearest neighbor is basically taking one of the pixels and looking at each of the pixels around it so that it and get it into so it understands what the edging pixels look like. So then in the direction that it samples, it goes out with those samples, just looking at the nearest neighbor in the direction of increase. If you look at bilinear, my understanding of bilinear is the fact that bilinear looks at any two pixels and looks at the information between those two points, and it balances out based on an averaging between the two. So actually you get a lot more hard edges with bilinear. Because it's only looking in straight lines, it's looking at edges, it's looking at distances between pixels and colorations between pixels. So you end up with a lot more stylized of an upgrade with lots of sharper edges. It doesn't look natural in the same way. So if you're doing something that's heavily graphic-based as opposed to a person's face, bilinear may be the better choice. As far as bicubic goes, the reason that's better is because what it does is it looks at the pixel that it wants to upgrade and puts that at the center. So if you draw eight boxes around the outside of one box in the center, you've got a box of nine. Within that, there are four sets of four boxes, all of which include the center pixel. So it looks at the top four, the bottom right four, the bottom left four, and the top left four. And then from the information that it's identified in each of those cubes, and there's four of those cubes, it looks at increasing and matching the pixel densities and those kind of things between those four. Okay, so it's an algorithm across nine pixels around the single pixel, or eight pixels around the single pixel that it's upscaling, which is much more accurate. Now, the thing is, what you'll get with that is bicubic interpolation gives an awful lot smoother effect to things. So if you've got lots of curves, it's perfect for people's faces because it'll give you some edge definition, but you'll get a very smooth transition between them. If you go back to the early days of Photoshop, you know, sort of version 5 or something like that, right at the very beginning before they started the CS crap, you'll probably find that you wouldn't choose bilinear. You would choose bilinear for nearly every upscaling because of the fact that you used chunky graphics and it took less time. If you used bicubic, the problem with bicubic was because it was sampling from four separate things, four separate cubes within that single cube, it would take forever. And the bicubic algorithm used to just slow your machine down to absolutely nothing. By the time they'd hit seven, providing you got a 386 with a decent processor in it, it would hang for a minute. You'd see a little creep up or a little unwind of the ball or something like that, and then bang, it would just do it. But it would be a couple of seconds before it did it. Now, based on current processor powering machines, it makes no odds. Each of them are as fast in appearance. But when you go back to the early days of Photoshop, bicubic interpolation, you'd only use that when you wanted a seriously good result because it took for bloody ever. There you go. One problem that you get with bicubic interpolation, though, is you get like halos. You can end up with ghosting effects around the outside of the curves and things like that if you go too much. So, like I said, 140% is about your maximum. But that's it. It makes no sense to me at all. I'm really confused, says Adam. It makes sense to me, says Batwench. There you go. There we go. Batwench got it. She's an engineering genius. You can get it. Gary from Swindon's written in again. Hello, Ewan. Thanks always, as always, for the show. I've learned so much in the past 2 years of listening. I recently bought a 2x converter to go with my 100mm 2.8 Canon macro lens. A, will my teleconverter increase the detail of my macro lens up close? I'm guessing it's yes, but I've thought about it and my brain hurts. Yes, it will, mate. Well done. Will I get more out of my teleconverter because of the cropping factor on my camera body? It's a 600D. No, you won't, mate. It's a factoring process, so it'll just increase by twice. It won't increase by 2.2 times just because you've got a crop sensor. 140% increases Batwench is like going from A4 to A3. Thank you. Exactly. There we go. That's it. Darren in Carlisle's written in. Hi, Ewan. Love the show. Many thanks. I've got a problem with Photoshop. I recently bought CS6 and I'm having a problem with colour of images. I shoot in NEF RAW on my Nikon D800, and when I open the images to edit, they look exactly like they did on the camera when I shot them. Once I've finished editing in the camera RAW processor, I click open and they open in Photoshop Editor, but are a greeny yellow haze in colour. I can then adjust the colours back to normal using hue and saturation, but when they're viewed in Finder or Preview, they look natural as well. I've calibrated my screen and that's not the issue, but I can't stop it from happening. Any suggestions you can offer would be great. Thanks, Darren. I think that's a colour settings issue. Now, you've got to bear in mind when you look at the thing that you've got on the back of your camera, your LCD screen, that shows a JPEG. It's not the RAW file. The RAW file is something else. You've just got a thumbnail JPEG that appears there, and I think they just put it in a sector of the disk that you never get access to. But it's not the full thing. Now, if you open Photoshop, you'll see on the camera RAW processor at the very bottom, it'll say Adobe sRGB, or it'll say something else. It'll say sRGB. That's telling you what the color workspace is that you're working in. If that says Adobe RGB, and then when you click open, you're putting it out as an sRGB image, you may get hue and saturation changes when it does the conversion. You've got to bear in mind that Adobe 1998 is done for the purposes of CMYK analysis, so it's there to try and give you a representation of how it's going to look through a four-color output, not through a three-color output. So if you're going through a four-color and three-color output, or if when you open it in Photoshop, the default's opening it in CMYK, which I don't think it would be, it should be opening it up in RGB 8-bit, then that could be causing it. Is it to do with the colour setting on your camera? No, it's not, because when you shoot in RAW, it's RAW. The sRGB and Adobe RGB settings in your camera only cover output to JPEG. So it's not that. It's definitely not that. I think look at the colour space in your workspace on the camera RAW setting and change that to sRGB, and then make sure when it opens in the colour space in Photoshop, that's in sRGB as well, and it should go away. Write in and let me know, Darren, because that's the only thing I can think it is. It ain't calibration, though, from what you've written there. I've got no idea what it is, if it's not going to fix with that. But I say colour space issues. There's my thoughts. I'm probably wrong. If you want to correct me on how wrong my interpretation of bicubic interpolation is, because it may well be, then feel free to write to me at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. Try and keep it civil if you can, and use some pleasantries. And if you use the word arse, I'll just delete it. And Darren, write in and tell me what your camera RAW problem looks like now after you've had a go at changing it and the colour space, so that we know. That'd be good. They've gone off into the chat room. The show title's crap sensor. just to confirm my increase comment, says Batwinch, so it's A4 to A3. What do they call it? They say one word and your brain is actually thinking another. Freudian slip, says Windrider. I can't read what the next one says. Never mind. If you've got a question, send it to us. BritishTechNetwork@gmail.com. We'll read it out. We'll do the stuff. UK2 sponsor this podcast. They're awesome. They're picking up. I'm doing a little voiceover stuff for them at the moment, which is pretty cool, for a new website builder thing that's coming out. So you've got the lowdown on it there. They've got great services. They do tons of stuff for web. You can buy domains through them, all that kind of stuff. Paul Wright's tweeted out this week. He's bought a couple of domains again through UK2. If you do buy from them, make sure you include us and you include them in a tweet or something like that, or a hashtag for #UK2 or British Tech Network #UK2, something like that, and say thanks very much, because they get nothing other than sales from you guys buying their services. You are buying their services. They love supporting us and we love supporting them. Craig hopefully is coming to the bash, and I might be ending up seeing him tomorrow afternoon briefly, because I'm down in London. If you're in London, you can come and have a beer, but tomorrow may not be tomorrow now by the time you listen to the podcast, obviously, so there we go. Who would have thought that a Brummie accent could sell stuff, says Batwinch. You might be surprised, girl. I'll play you some results after the thing's finished. Go to uk2.net through our website and then come back and use all our offer codes. We get the kudos, you get great savings, UK2 get a very happy sponsorship with us. They've been with us for 3 years. They're going to be with us for another 2 years. They're brilliant. Please look after them because they look after us. Right. We'll be back again next week. If you'd like to come and watch us, I think we're all going to be on Friday again next week instead of Thursday as we are this week. Send in your questions and send in anything else you want me to read out. And please, 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 we've had no reviews this week. So if you can, give us a review in iTunes of the podcast. Photoshow doesn't get a huge amount, but do the video and the photo, please. It'd be really cool. It makes a huge difference to our rankings. Thanks ever so much to everyone that has already. See you next week. Thanks for listening. Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.